Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 261, and we're going to talk about places where you can start looking for your new rig and how to embrace the beginner's mind. Yeah, it's a little fun. We're also going to talk about a strange place to put solar that could be just what you need to fit everything on your rig, and a very, very long tale from the very, very long road. In fact, I almost made this entire episode a tale from the road because things have been crazy since we last spoke. But first, I have to thank you for letting me take a week off, not that you had any choice, and also thank you for your patience in the fact that this episode is a day late, and that's because of the story that I will tell here eventually. But the most important thing I'm going to say now is thank you to everyone who reached out with words of encouragement and kindness. I really appreciate it. I didn't expect it. You know, I'm just like this guy talking into the wind, and I sometimes forget that there are actual people who actually listen. And a lot of you reached out with sympathies and empathies and encouragement and financial support, which I completely didn't expect. I'll get to that later. But yeah, thank you guys. I really appreciate it, and you've encouraged me to keep going with renewed vigor. Although, boy, time is tough these days. So, have you heard of the beginner's mind? The beginner's mind, this is a concept in Zen Buddhism. I'm, again, not a very religious person, but I will take concepts where I can find them, and I find this concept useful. And it's the idea that as a beginner, you have a unique perspective on things because you have not drawn any conclusions, you don't have any biases yet, you're actually seeing the big picture without being able to understand any of it in great depth. And this is a unique state. This is a good state. However, your goal is to get out of that state, especially when it comes to figuring out how you're going to buy the rig that you want. Yes, I'm including Zen Buddhism here in the process for purchasing a new rig. But now I find myself in that state again. I mean, you know my van life journey here. I've had a bunch of RVs, I've gone through several different cycles, and now I find myself without a van, and I'm back at beginner state looking at, what do I want to do? What are my resources? How can I accomplish what I want to do with the resources I have? And so I look at all the options. Okay, I need a vehicle, and I have a vehicle. I have a truck. Okay, I have a pickup truck. That's going to be my vehicle. Boom, gone, done. Okay, we've got that out of the way. Now, I need a camper. Well, with a pickup truck, you've got two basic options for campers. You can get a trailer or a truck camper. And I look at my different options, and I think, you know, I want to try a truck camper. Okay, so now I'm in truck camper world. And just like that, I've gone from having beginner's mind to having a biased mind where I'm only looking at truck campers, which is interesting because I have never had a truck camper. Of all the RVs I've had in my life, and there have been many, never had a truck camper. I've never even loaded a truck camper until very recently. So I thought I should talk about this process of actually finding a rig, in this case a truck camper, and how it might be informative for you who might be in a similar situation. With your beginner's mind, I first recommend you take a look at all your options. I mean, yes, okay, you need to look at your resources. How much money do you have? That's a good one. What kind of parking do you have? What kind of driving are you comfortable with? How much are you okay to sacrifice gas mileage? How much space do you need? Will you be traveling with pets? There's a whole big long line of questions that you should be asking yourself, which, by the way, will be included in my book that I have not abandoned. It is just regretfully on hold because I can't find the time to sit and write lately, but I'm hoping that will change this summer. Anyway, that aside, answer all those questions for yourself. And then when you come down to what kind of a rig you actually want, you have a very basic decision to make at first. New or used? I am always going to recommend used. Unless money is no object and you know exactly what you want and a manufacturer can actually give you that thing. That is not a common scenario. In most cases, used is going to be better simply because of depreciation. RVs depreciate faster than automobiles, and you know the old expression that as soon as you drive the car off the lot, it's worth 20% less, etc. It's even worse with RVs. The RV depreciation rate is something like 30 or 40% once it leaves the lot. And then it goes down drastically, and then it plateaus. And then you reach this point where even 5 years later, it has maintained that same value. And for a few different brands, it can actually stay there for a very long time. Scamp is one, Airstream is one, and that's about it. I mean, some of the truck campers like Lance and Alaskan and Four Wheel Camper and some of the higher end ones do hold their value better. But I would actually recommend, don't go crazy if this is your first rig. Be modest, because you don't know what's going to change, you don't know what you're going to like, and a lot of people get a rig and then change it fairly quickly as they learn more about what they're looking for. New or used? That's the question you're trying to answer. Well, new is easy, right? If you choose new, you go to the dealers, you go to the websites, and you go through that process. And that's how it works. And you're going to pay top dollar, but that's because you're willing to do that to get exactly what you want. That's fine. Now let's look at used, which I think is where most of us are going to be coming from. The used market is weird, and it has been for a while. For cars right now, the used market is just kind of ridiculous, where some used cars cost as much as the new ones, and that math is just really strange right now. But let's focus on RVs and vans and things like that. Where do you actually look? I got my first RV in 1986 from a newspaper advertisement. That was how it was done then. We had that, and we had this thing called The Big Nickel, which was a monthly little tiny newspaper thing that you could put classified ads in, and there was another thing called Auto Trader, which is the same thing. That was how you did it. Or you went to RV dealers and you just looked and see what they had in their lots, that kind of a thing. My first was a 77 Toyota Chinook, a very fun little camper, and those actually have maintained their value even after all these years, and that's how I got it. And then fast forward a few decades, I was always recommending RV Trader, because which is basically a digital version of the old Auto Trader, because it was somewhat vetted, because people had to pay money to put it on there, and they had a really good selection. But this recent experience now of trying to buy a truck camper, I have found that it's not great for what I'm trying to do. And then we've got the upstarts like Craigslist, which is pretty old now, but still, I'll call it an upstart, Marketplace, which are places where people can list things for free, and you maybe they're real, maybe they're not, who knows? You're taking a lot of chances there. Oh, and also on the side, I'll mention eBay Motors. You can buy cars and vehicles on eBay, but lately I have found that they're changing focus, it seems. I did buy my ambulance through eBay, so that is a thing you can do. Looking for a truck camper, here's what I have discovered recently of all these different options. First, RV Trader is useless for buying a truck camper. It's not entirely useless, but nearly everything that is listed on there is from a dealership, which is not ideal, and is for a higher end rig. There are no $5,000 used truck campers on RV Trader, at least that I could find. So that was disappointing, because that was a source that I had used and was happy about. From there, I went to eBay and looked to see, and there was nothing at all. I found absolutely nothing. Like, okay, well, what now? So I went to some of the dealer networks. A lot of these dealers, like Camping World, have like big networks where they list all their inventory across multiple different dealerships. Looked through there, found very little, most of it high-end, but nothing in the sub-$10,000 range, which is where I'm looking. Well, heck, I know people are buying and selling truck campers. Where? And the answer is it's on Facebook Marketplace. That's about the only place where you can go and buy a truck camper these days that has any type of a selection. Craigslist had some, but Craigslist searching is very difficult in that they only limit you to certain areas, and it's difficult to expand that area far enough if you're willing to drive, and who knows, their listings are just somebody put something up and you don't know if it's still there, you know, whatever. So I didn't find anything I was even interested in looking at on Craigslist, but a marketplace. I literally found dozens and dozens of truck campers that I would be interested in. Now, this is specifically about truck campers. If I were looking for a van, I would be probably looking for a used cargo van, and you can grade yourself down there. I mean, you can start with like CarMax, CarGuru, then you can go to, say, Truck Trader, which is another site. There are a couple of sites just for converted camper vans, that type of thing. But it's more of an automotive problem, so you can just go through the automotive channels to find vans. For this, I want to talk specifically about non-motorized options. For trailers, if you're looking at a trailer, right now, that is the best value in my opinion. There are any number of 20 to 25 foot trailers out there, fairly new, all very much cookie cutter. I mean, they're all basically the same shape and with the same amenities from like 20 different companies, although that's probably really only three different companies. There's tons of them out there. This is a golden time to be buying a travel trailer right now. I mean, except that the quality on travel trailers has gone way down. According to most reports, that's probably true of truck camper too. But there's tons and tons of them out there. So I would say if you're looking for a travel trailer, that's where you should take a look at RV Trader. I think you'll still find good stuff there. But back to truck campers. Yeah, the only option really is Facebook Marketplace. Now, searching on Facebook Marketplace is a pain in the butt. I mean, first off, you have to have a Facebook account. And I know that's rapidly becoming something for old people. But if you want the biggest variety of stuff for this specific thing, that's where they are. And weirdly, the same is true for six-wheel drive ATVs. There's certain things that you can only get on Facebook Marketplace. When you search for these things, you search on words, and that's it. I mean, you can set a range, and you can set a price, and some other thing. One of the many problems with Facebook Marketplace is that they don't really limit people in how they put up listings. They can use any words they want. There are very few categories. So, for example, some people use the term truck camper. Some people use the word slide in. Some of them are called caps or toppers, depending on what they are. Some people can't spell. You can't just go and say, hey, show me all the truck campers for sale within 100 miles of here. It kind of looks like you can do that, but in reality, you can't. It's almost like a slot machine, you know, you hit search and you pull the arm and things spin and then there's like truck camper, an old plastic dollhouse from the 1970s. The search results are crazy. I don't know why the plastic dollhouse comes up, maybe because the word house is in there and it's thinking, campers, houses, they're similar, let's throw that, I don't know. It's bizarre. It's maddening. It is a very unsatisfying searching experience. Also, the people who are putting the ads up, they don't know what they're talking about. A lot of these people ended up with this thing somehow. Someone passed away, or a partner left, or they bought it years ago and they forgot everything about it. They don't know the weight. They don't know the model number. They don't know who made it. They're like, it's a camper. Everything works. And that's it. And how do you search on that? You see the problem. So once you get through all the searching and you just find stuff, what I recommend you do is keep a separate list, like even create a little spreadsheet of these things with as much information as you can. And then even though there is a save function, it doesn't really work very well. It's very, very frustrating. And then it only gets worse. So what you'll typically do is you'll go through this and you come up with a list. This is good, this is good, this is good. And you try to find some close enough that you can see them. And with truck campers, you've got a few things to worry about, right? You want to make sure it'll fit on your truck. Payload is very important on trucks and is somewhat deceptive. More on that later. And you've got the basic question of whether you want one that has a pop-up or is solid wall where there is no pop-up. My assumption was that pop-up truck campers were lighter. I thought, well, it's just fabric in there. That's got to be lighter. But it turns out that the mechanism and the roof that requires extra strength, since it's sort of standalone, adds so much weight that the weights are comparable. So, you know, go for what you want. If weight is your concern, a pop-up does not help that much, which I thought was really interesting. I kept checking the numbers over and over again, and sure enough, there was maybe 100 pounds difference. It wasn't very much. Now, if you're lucky, you will find something close to you that you want to look at. And then the only way to get in touch with the person is to send them a message on Facebook Messenger, which is built into their Facebook Marketplace search. The problem is a lot of the people posting don't understand this. They don't use Facebook very much. This is what they just, I'm putting this up for a friend. You'll see that a lot. Or my father-in-law asked me to put this up, whatever. And then it will say, please call, and it'll give a phone number, except it won't, because Facebook won't allow that. So if you say, please call 555-121-1212, it will say hidden information. And then that person who put the post up, who probably doesn't check Facebook more than once a month, has no idea that you're messaging them. Hey, I'd like to buy your camper. Hey, I've got cash. See my cash? I'm waving cash in your face. They never see it. And then you end up just frustrated because you see the perfect thing you want and you have no way to get in touch with the person. That's one pitfall. Another pitfall is it's rife with scammers. Anything that's free these days has lots of scammers, and there are people who will put up exactly the rig you want, and it's a really good price, like a really good price. And maybe they'll play dumb, like they might say, well, we don't really know what this is, but it's been in our yard for a while, and we just like, give us $5,000 for it. And then you look and you see it's like a 1995 Alaskan that is worth significantly more than $5,000, and you're like, ooh, this looks like a good opportunity. And so you contact them and they say, well, sure, you can come look at it. But I'll tell you what, I got three other people coming in the next couple days. If you don't want me to sell it to them, you better give me a deposit. And you see how that goes. And then they disappear as soon as they get that deposit. The listing comes down. You have no way to contact them because, again, you don't have a phone number. That is bad. But let's say, fine, you finally get somebody who will talk with you. The very, very, very first thing you want to do is get off of Facebook and do communication via phone or email or something else that's a little bit more real. In my case, I use the phone. I would not deal with anybody who wouldn't give me their phone number. That's my bottom line. That's my scammer test. If I can call them and they can call me, that's enough that I will continue the transaction. But if they're not willing to do that, then that's the end right there. I think that is a fairly good safety thing, although it's not perfect. I mean, people can have fake phone numbers, obviously. So I talked with a few people about truck campers. I saw a few that I liked, and inevitably, this pattern happened. I would say, hey, I like your truck camper. Can you answer a few questions for me? They would answer a couple of questions and then stop, which I thought was odd. And then I would be like, well, can I come visit it? And then, like, within an hour, it would suddenly be sold and gone. And I don't know if that was just my bad luck, or if I was keying in on the really nice campers that a lot of other people were, or if this was some kind of a scam, where as soon as somebody's interested and is asking questions, they get scared and then cancel it, and so you can't track that. I don't know. Remember, it's really easy to find pictures of anything you want on the internet, or make your own with AI and create a listing. You can't trust anything. So my advice, if you are looking for a rig, and specifically a truck camper, because that's what I've been looking for lately, is you have to be very careful as to who you're dealing with. But get a phone number, get a name, get as much information as you can. Know that you're dealing with folks who are not professional salespeople. Some of them have terrible communication skills. One guy I was dealing with, I think he just didn't know how to type, but any kind of typed communication was terrible. I couldn't tell if he spoke English, and I was just like, oh, this is going to go nowhere. And then finally he said, why don't you give me a call, gave me his phone number, which, and then I called him, and he was just a regular old guy, and we had a great conversation. He told me the whole history of the rig, and I was going to go visit it, and then he finally said, I have someone coming in an hour. If it doesn't sell, I'll let you know, and then that guy bought it. So that is my experience of trying to buy a rig today. Now, make sure that if you do this with any of these, remember, this is all caveat emptor. You are responsible for not getting yourself in trouble. Never let them know you have cash. I mean, you can say, I'll pay in cash, but never let them know you have it with you. When you go to visit them, as soon as they start talking about money, you can say, oh, yeah, the money's no problem. There's a bank in town where I can get it. Let's not worry about that. Let's just talk about the deal. That's because if you let them know you have the cash with you, then you're putting yourself at a bit of risk. So come up with a plausible story about why you don't have the cash with you. maybe have someone come meet you, or say you have to make a phone call, whatever. But never like show up with a wad of cash. That's bad. And then you have to negotiate to the best of your negotiating skills. There are a number of negotiating techniques. I am not a great negotiator, but, you know, be honest. My approach to negotiating, honestly, and I'm not saying this is a good approach, is if they're asking a fair price, I'm willing to pay it. Because I think that's kind of the point of a transaction, is this is fair, I'm willing to pay fair, let's do that. I am not always looking for a deal. I'm not always looking for the best price. I know that's how society seems to be organized, is that if they didn't come down in their price, you got ripped off. And I don't think that's necessarily true in some cultures. I obviously understand that many cultures that is the default. You ask for 100, they offer 30, and you end up paying 60, and everyone knows it's going to happen. That's what's going to happen in the first place. But anyway, whatever. So that's just my take. You do what you should do. But should you ever want to negotiate on the price, being there is your best time if you can wait that long. And when you start looking at the rig, make a list of every flaw you see and explain your difficulties with that flaw. For example, if there's something cosmetically bad, you can say, oh, my wife really won't like this, and I've got to convince her that this is the rig we should get. So that's going to be tricky. Or if there's any kind of water or dampness, I mean, that's worth a lot of money. Anytime you see that, definitely, first off, that's a serious issue, okay? So don't just blow that off. But second, that's worth a lot of money. Anyway, it's a little rough out there right now. It's a very uncertain environment for buying a new rig. But I'm sorry to say this, but Facebook Marketplace is the best place to find the largest number of rigs in a low-end price range. But it's a lot of work. Thank you to, and this is a big thank you to Justin, Wildenschmidt, Greg, Naraj, and Nate. All of you were incredibly generous in this period, and I really appreciate it. And I can tell you guys, there aren't going to be any ads on this podcast for the rest of the year, even if nobody gives me anything for the rest of the year, thanks to these guys and everyone else who's donated. But if you would like to support the podcast, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And you can buy me a gallon of diesel that I will have to use in my tractor since my van died. I'm probably going to have to change that to something else. Hey, give me suggestions. What should I change it to? Buy me a gallon of gasoline. It's kind of boring. I could always be buy me a coffee. Anyway, I will take suggestions. If you have ideas, send me a note at jeff@built2go.com. Also, 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And really, thank you guys. I appreciate it. Thus ends the closest thing to an ad that this podcast has. Van Life News. I have to thank Darren and Karen, the rhyming twins, for giving me this week's news. The funny thing about Darren and Karen is they've become dedicated to sending me news, which I really appreciate. But they're not caught up on the podcast. They're listening in order, and they just told me that they're at episode 160. And they wrote me an email saying, oh no, we heard you were thinking of selling the van. Don't sell the van. And well, if they're hearing this, I'm assuming that means they've caught up. And yeah, 100 episodes later, the whole world is different. Anyway, thanks, Darren and Karen. I really appreciate it. No matter when you listen to this, I do appreciate you giving me the news. So the first bit of news they sent is from Yahoo Tech. And the article refers to, of course, BBC. It's funny how, like, this article references, these articles all reference other articles. It's really hard to figure out who wrote this first. This one is Yahoo Tech references BBC Travel, who referenced a Facebook post. And it is, anyway, it's a really cool conceptual electric camper van that first was visualized, shall we say, in 2020. And now, well, they're making a little bit of progress. It is called the Estella Vita. And what's really cool about this super futuristic looking vehicle is that it's entirely solar powered. So this thing was built by the Solar Team Eindhoven at the Eindhoven University of Technology. Apologies if I mispronounced that. It's a two-person camper. Has, you know, a kitchen, bed, shower, toilet, and a fold-out solar canopy. See, folks, this is the future. We are wanting more and more solar in our vehicle, but we don't have the roof real estate for it. You know, if we could have 1,200 watts of solar in our vehicle, imagine the stuff we could do. It's going to be your awning. Your awning is going to be a giant solar panel. And that might not be great while you're driving, but that's not when you really need it the most. When you park, you can have this awning that's going to be your solar panel. That's the future if we get the future we deserve. Anyway, this thing has that. But it also has a 60 kilowatt hour lithium ion battery that gives you 450 miles on a sunny day, and they say typically 373. You know how these things are with range. But that's pretty darn good, especially when you consider they didn't have to plug it in. That's right, this vehicle is completely solar-powered, including the drivetrain. Now, we've talked about that in the past, and I've explained what a difficult problem it is to get enough energy from the sun to actually power a vehicle. But just because a problem's difficult doesn't mean it's impossible, and these guys are trying to solve it. And when you park the vehicle, it's always charging as long as the sun's out. So one of the ways they're accomplishing this is that it's a very lightweight van. It's obviously not gigantic. You can't stand up in it. It's very, very aerodynamic. In fact, it kind of looks like a long, stretched Prius. I think it's a pretty cool idea. And this is more than just a mock-up prototype. They've actually done an 1,800-mile trip in it from the Netherlands to Spain, using only solar, although they do admit to taking advantage of plug-ins when they were available. So I'll have a link in the show notes to this article. This is pie-in-the-sky stuff right now. Just because they built one vehicle doesn't mean you're going to see them driving all over the place. But it's hopeful, and I could use a little more hope, so I would love to see this happen. And the folks at Starlink have a new dish called the Performance Dish. Yeah! But no, seriously, this is potentially kind of cool. This is a dish meant for people who are off-roading or doing something where the dish gets shaken around a bit. And they're saying that it may be capable of gigabit speeds. And we're getting there, folks. This thing, put it on top of a Jeep, you can go anywhere and you can always have super fast internet everywhere you go. And isn't that what we want? That's what we want. I can say that right now. That is what everybody wants. I want internet all the time as fast as possible, regardless of where I am. That would work, right? One of the issues with Starlink dishes has been that they're kind of unwieldy. You know, they move around and they are on this pedestal thing and usually have to take them down and put them up. And there are some mobile solutions, but they're a little bit janky. This is hoping to fix all that. And you may have figured out that there's a little caveat here. And that caveat is that they're about $2,000. Yeah, all right, it's $2,000. But if you are the kind of person who is crossing the Sahara on the regular, this might be something to look into. But yeah, it's a waterproof, low profile. It's not that big of a thing. It's smaller than a 100-watt solar panel, and you mount it to your roof and you're done. And then it's supposed to get you these great speeds. Now, remember, that's $2,000 just for the dish. How much is it for the service? Well, that changes all the time. Starlink is a little weird about their pricing, and sometimes you can roam and sometimes you can't and all that, and that's always going to change depending on the whims of the people who run Starlink. One good thing, though, about this is that it can handle winds up to 170 miles an hour, so if you're planning on driving into a hurricane, this might be a good choice. It's salt water capable, so for folks on sailboats and stuff, it has a 10-year lifespan in a salty environment, which is obviously very corrosive. And a really good thing, it now draws only 70 watts of power, down from 110. That's a big jump, shorter jump. Anyway, it uses less power, and that's always a good thing. So, link in the show notes. It looks like Starlink is continuing to innovate, and I approve. So, remember all the hype about the ID Buzz earlier this year? And, of course, those people in our community were like, but we want the camper version. We want the California that I saw in Austria that we can't get in the U.S. Well, it doesn't look like the ID Buzz is going to be around very long either. They only sold 2,000 units in the U.S. in Q1, and the bottom line is nobody's buying these things. And it's probably because they're so darn expensive. I mean, they're about $75,000 for, and it's just a van. It's just a minivan at this point. It's cool. It's retro. I think it's nice and sleek and fun, but that's a lot of money, and we want the camper van version. So, yeah, I think the ID Buzz in the U.S. anyway may become one of these niche vehicles that you see once in a while, but they're going to end up in the collections of people with more money than anything else, and we're not going to see these in everyday life, which means there are not going to be a lot of used ones on the market for folks to turn into campers. And that's kind of sad. So I'm sorry to end the news on a somewhat sad note, but that is how it goes. Thanks again to Darren and Karen for the news. Tech Talk! I want to address a very specific issue about payload safety, and this can happen to anybody. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you have, if you have too much weight in the back, that creates a problem that is not necessarily obvious. So I'll use my truck as an example, 2019 Ram 1500 Classic. It has coil spring suspension, which means it's a fairly comfortable ride, but they're just not great for weight. And what happens when you put a lot of weight in the back of the truck is that it squats. The bed goes way down. And if you put too much weight back there, what happens is that the front end starts to go up. Now, it may not even be obvious. It's not like the wheels are in the air. But if the gap between the tire and the body increases because of weight in the back, that's very, very bad. And the reason it's bad is because weight is being taken off your front wheels, and you need your front wheels to steer. And the situation can be that if your vehicle is loaded poorly like that, your front wheels, when they hit a bump, can jump in the air. And then you've got no steering. Remember, the only way a vehicle steers is if those wheels are touching the ground. This happened on my truck. Again, story coming. But my truck warned me. The truck actually has anti-skid control, and the lights came on every time I hit a bump recently, and I realized that what had happened was my load was terrible, and my front wheels were actually not making enough contact with the ground. It's a terrible, dangerous situation. In order to avoid this, make sure when you load any vehicle, van, car, truck, whatever it is, that the heaviest things are low and towards the front as much as possible. You want as little weight as possible behind the rear wheels. Now, I know on some of these extended vans, that's a very convenient place to put that because they basically have this big butt that sticks out, big empty space back there, very little underneath that gets in the way. So, hey, put your water tanks back there and your batteries and motorcycle and... Well, you're putting all the weight behind the rear wheel, and think about how levers work. All the weight that you put back there pivots on the rear wheels and lifts up the front wheels. That's bad. So, should you load your vehicle and it starts riding funny, take that very, very seriously, because it doesn't take long at all for you to get in serious trouble and flip or go out of control or whatever. It's a very serious issue. I don't hear enough people talking about it, but too much weight in the back means your front end is too light, which gives you less control over the vehicle. It's also not good for your tires. It can make your tires wear funny, and your springs are going to be working a lot harder. And if you have a front-wheel drive vehicle, like let's say you do this at a ProMaster, which is a little hard because of the way their wheels are, that's going to be hilarious. Because you're going to go over a bump, and your wheels are going to go, and then some computer will take over and say, hey, something's wrong here. And I don't know what it'll do, but yeah. Anyway. Pay some attention to how you load your vehicles. It is super important. There's lots of advice out there, but it all boils down to you want things to be low, front, and center. All your heavy things should be there. Unfortunately, that's also where you want to be, and there aren't too many people putting their water tanks in the middle of their floor. You do the best you can and try to balance as much as possible. Product review. I have not tested this product, but I am intrigued, especially given my recent incident with my hazard lights killing the battery of my truck. You know what annoys me is that the truck has a timeout feature for the headlights. Like if I leave the dome light on, it'll time out and turn off the dome light. If I leave the headlights on, it'll time out, shut off the headlights. But not the hazard lights, which makes sense, right? It's a hazard. For some reason, you have these on. It's an emergency. You don't want them shut off. But yeah, it will absolutely let the hazard lights just drain the battery all the way down. So, all right, I guess it makes sense. But that would not have happened had I purchased one of these. And this is a hood-mounted solar panel. These are specifically for keeping your starter battery charged, but you can use them for whatever you want. It's just a solar panel. What's different about these is that it's a thin, flexible solar panel that is custom shaped for the hood of your vehicle. And then usually they have their own solar controller or you have to add one, but the wires come out, they go usually between the back of your hood and your windshield and then to your battery, and they keep your battery charged. What's great about this is that it doesn't take up any space on your roof. And also, if you have a big hood, like a pickup truck generally has a big hood, you can actually do your solar there rather than on, say, your truck camper or your trailer or whatever. All you have to do is get the power from there to your leisure battery. And you can actually do that just by charging up the starter battery, and then you can use a battery-to-battery charger from there. And then even if the truck is off, provided you didn't install that sensing wire that the engine has to be running, the solar will charge the starter battery. The starter battery will be at such a voltage that it will keep sending current back to the leisure battery, and you will essentially have solar on the hood of the vehicle charging your leisure batteries. Or, if you're just doing it for space, you just connect that directly to your leisure batteries. These are a little bit different than the flexible solar panels you can just buy as flexible solar panels. They're shaped and they're adhesive. Now, the better ones have a clear bit of vinyl adhesive that goes on your hood to protect it, and then this adheres to that. And then if you want to remove it, you can remove the whole thing, and you're not going to be leaving any sticky residue behind, hopefully. Although, given the way the sun oxidizes paint, etc., you may still have a mark where it was. So keep that in mind. If you put one of these things on your hood, you're probably going to leave a mark over time. Also, what wattage capacity they are is going to vary very much on your vehicle. You need a bigger hood for more, and some vehicles, like my Dodge, have weird-shaped hoods. The Dodge does not have a flat hood. It's kind of like a mountain in the middle, and the solar panel isn't going to wrap around the whole thing. It's just going to sit in the middle part. So it's not going to be a huge, high-capacity solar panel, but it's going to be well more than enough to keep my starter battery charged. So I am looking into it. The only reason I haven't jumped on it right now is that they're expensive. The cost per watt hour is something like triple or four times the cost of traditional solar. So even though it seems a convenient place to put it, and it has the side benefit of reducing glare from the hood, I've got a big bright white truck and the glare off the hood comes right into my eyes while I'm driving, it probably makes more sense to use the roof of your vehicle, if it's a van or your wherever, your camper, than to actually do this on the hood simply due to price. However, I am intrigued, and now that we have these low-profile batteries that I'll talk more about in a future episode, I think you can get in some really interesting installations here where the components are starting to mold themselves to the shape of your vehicle, and you're not just stuck with squares that you have to make fit on something that doesn't have any right angles at all. I'm not going to link this in the show notes or anything. You can search on this. You can search for hood solar panel. There's a whole bunch of different makers. I haven't done enough research to be able to recommend a brand or anything like that. I just want you to be aware that that is an option, that there are solar panels made specifically for the hoods of vehicles, and these will work better on some than others. Obviously, if you have like a ProMaster that barely has a hood at all, this is probably not a great solution. But a pickup truck or an SUV or a van with a good-sized nose, yeah, this actually could be a pretty cool thing. Tales from the road. Okay. I'm going to try to do this. My wife and I went on a cruise. We came back from the cruise on Sunday. I got home Sunday. I was tired from traveling. You know, travel's tiring. In fact, the worst part of the trip, despite, you know, with flights and cruises and buses and all that, the worst part is always getting from O'Hare, the airport in Chicago, to our condo. That is always the worst part of the entire trip. It's stop-and-go traffic in a stinky taxi, and the taxi drivers only think of gas pedals as on-off switches, and I get car sick every time. I hate it. But for numbers of reasons that I won't get into here, that is our best option, so I put up with it. So do that. Okay. I get home, I'm kind of hungry, but I don't feel like doing anything about it. So I look in the fridge, and oh, there's some salsa. So I grab the salsa and some chips and munch away, and everything's fine. The evening, I start not to feel so good. I'm like, I'm probably just tired, whatever. So I go to bed, and I had food poisoning. Yeah, and apparently, based on evidence, it was from the salsa. So no, I didn't catch Noro on the ship or anything like that. This wasn't Noro. I just stupidly ate salsa that had been in the fridge too long. I mean, after all, we've been gone for like 9 days, and it was open before that, so okay, my bad. Food poisoning is horrible, but at least it doesn't last very long. So, I get through that and suffer through it on Monday. I'm a complete basket case, don't get anything done. And then on Tuesday, I sit down and get some things done. And then at the end of the day, my right knee, which is not my left ankle, which is where I had my surgery, starts to really hurt. And then I find myself at midnight in very high level of pain, like, should I go to the ER kind of pain. I can't move my knee, I can't straighten it out, I can't walk on it, I can't stand on it, I can't find a comfortable place to put it, and it was pretty bad. So finally, my wife, the doctor, drugged me to sleep, thank you, which I appreciated very much. And I managed to finally sleep for a few hours. And in the morning, now this is Wednesday we're talking about here, Wednesday morning, I talked with my wife about what I should do about this, because I have a whole lot of stuff to do, and not being able to walk is really not a good thing. And she suggested I go to the Illinois Bone and Joint Institute, which is an orthopedic place that strangely has walk-up hours. You can just kind of walk in and talk to an orthopedist immediately, kind of like how medicine should work. I don't know how they can do this, but nobody else can. Anyway, I do that, I go through the process, all the paperwork, blah 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 blah, and an hour and a half later I have a diagnosis of quadriceps tendonitis, which is a very painful condition, and that's usually a sport injury. I'm not a sports guy. I have no idea how I ended up with this. Why? I just have no explanation. I don't know. There was no trauma. I'm like, okay, this is my new challenge. Wonderful. And then I look on Facebook, and I see that a camper that I've had my eye on, that I was talking to the guy off the coast of Cuba on the ship about this, and I was going to go look at it, but then it sold, which is a pattern. It was back. It didn't sell. And here I am, 9 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday. I have the podcast to do, but I also can't walk. I'm in a considerable amount of pain, and the truck camper I want, that's a very good price, is 3.5 hours away. And if I want that truck camper, I need to drive 3.5 hours. But before I do that, I need to remove the shell off my truck in case I do buy it. The shell that weighs 300 pounds, that is in Chicago on my truck, that somehow needs to not be in Chicago, it needs to be in LaSalle County. And I'm just doing all the math, and I'm like, this is stupid. I can barely walk. I should just give up and say, well, if fate destines that I will have that truck camper, it will find... Yeah, I don't actually think like that, but I stupidly decided to go for the truck camper. I actually decided to go for it. And I went to Menards, bought some boards, spent an hour figuring out how to get a 300-pound camper shell off the back of my truck in my very tight parking space in my parking lot in Chicago. Managed to do that without too much damage, hopped in the truck, drove to Lansing, Michigan, which is in another time zone, and at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Eastern time, I was in Central time, I got to see the truck camper. Now, the truck camper was exactly what I wanted. It was the right size, it had the right features, and it was the right price. And I had been looking at truck campers for weeks, and I had noticed that these things don't last. I was having a really hard time finding one, which is why I was so motivated. So I'm finally there, and I'm finally looking at the truck camper. And I knew, this is a problem I have, and you should learn from this, because it's a bad trait. I knew that as soon as I saw this thing, I was going to find a way to buy it, regardless of whatever was wrong with it. That is a character flaw? That's my Boston accent sneaking in. Yes, that is a thing I have. Avoid that. However, from a distance, the thing looked pretty good. It's a 2017 Travelite 690W. It's a vehicle designed for half-ton trucks, which I have. But it looked a little weird in some places. And basically what somebody did had gone wild with silicone. Now, if you're in the RV industry at all, you know what that means. When you see a vehicle that has silicone all over it, you know, just that white silicone sealant, That means there's a leak and they haven't been able to find it, so they just decided to go crazy and cover up anything that could possibly look like a place that could leak. It's messy and ineffective. And I was like, okay, that's going to require work. And then sure enough, touring the inside, which looked very, very nice, everything worked. I lifted up one of the seats and there's a puddle of water under the seat. Fortunately, the seat was vinyl on the bottom, didn't affect the cushion, but there's water in there. Where did it come from? So I go to the guy selling it, and it's like, we need to explain this before we can proceed. And so he said, oh, he power washed it, and maybe that's what he didn't know. And at this point, I'm thinking in my head, I'm not letting him hear my conversation, is that if I buy this, I am buying a problem. I am buying a vehicle that has a problem, and I'm going to have to fix it. So the question is that worth it? And how much is that worth? So I'm like, okay, everything's perfect except for this, but this is a pretty big problem. And basically I say, look, there's something wrong here. It's obvious. Give me $1,000. And he did. He took $1,000 off the price right away, which was something like 18% of the total price. And yeah. I own a truck camper now. Yay! Except, there's been a few problems. This is just since yesterday. So after considerable time and effort, we get the truck loaded. The camper loaded onto the truck. Now my truck bed is an 8-foot bed. This is a 6-foot camper, so I've got 2 feet of space to play with. I have never actually loaded a truck camper on a truck before. All my RV experience is something I've never done. And this guy hadn't done it a lot either, but we figured it out. We got it on there. And as I'm putting it on, I noticed that some of the tie-downs wiggle. Pro tip, truck camper tie-downs should never wiggle. So, all right, it's too late now. I'd already signed the bill of sale. Well, he'd already signed the bill of sale. I'd already given the money. So this was a done deal. This was my camper at this point, for better or worse. And get it tied down very rudimentarily because I didn't... So when you put a truck camper on a truck, you have to configure the truck to be able to do that. You need tie downs in the truck that can handle this. And the tie downs on a truck camper on the outsides, the outer edges of the truck camper, which sticks out beyond the bed, that means you can't use the tie downs in the bed because if you did, the chain or whatever you're using would wrap over the sides of the bed and then go into the truck bed, and it's basically going to crush the sides of your truck. So you need to have either outriggers or something like that, and I didn't have those. Now, he told me that he had them, and I was counting on that, but the ones he had, which he forgot to give me, require a lot of installation, and nobody was interested in doing that at that time. So we get it loaded on there with ratchet straps, which is not the proper way to do it, but at that point, it was literally just cargo. I just had to move it 300 miles to LaSalle County where I could put it down and figure everything out. Okay, great. We do that. It's loaded on the truck. There's lots of space. Everything's fine. I wave goodbye, and I start driving off, and I'm like, God, I can't even tell the thing's there, you know? I've got a 5.7 liter Hemi. Yeah, whatever. The truck doesn't even seem to notice it. It did squat down a bit, but not terrible. The truck was fairly level. I was like, great. This is clearly the right camper for this vehicle. I stop and get some gas because gas is cheaper in Michigan than Illinois. And then I head out on the interstate and there's a ramp and I see a truck coming. So I speed up and then I'm at 55 miles an hour entering the freeway. And I'm like, okay, 70 mile an hour speed limit. And then I get up to 60. And then it begins. The truck starts to rock back and forth, side to side. Woom, woom, like in a resonant frequency. Now, I like the word resonance. It's a pretty word, but resonance is bad because resonance grows. It means that every time you go left and the vehicle goes right, it goes a little farther left and a little farther right, and then eventually you lose complete control of the vehicle. And there I am at 60 miles an hour with this rocking going on, and then the light comes on the dashboard indicating that my front wheels are coming off the ground. Not literally, not all the way, but enough that the computer has sensed a loss of traction, and I know that I am in a completely unstable state. So I pull off at the first exit, park in an empty lot, and I've got to figure this out. Looking at what causes this. First, tire pressure. Okay, well, I hope that's what it is. I happen to have an air compressor with me. I go and look, and yeah, no, my rear tires are at max pressure, so that's not the problem. And then I do a bit more research, and I find out that this is a known problem with Ram 1500 trucks because of the coil springs. Coil springs are literally just a spring, and they, unlike leaf springs, give side to side, not just up and down. And what was happening is that because they were so compressed from the weight of the camper, the vehicle was rocking and then creating this resonance that made it rock more and more until the vehicle was unstable. I can't fix that while I'm driving. I don't have a way to deal with that. Now, as it happened, I had the timbrons in the truck with me, but to install the timbrons, you need to take all the load off the truck. So I would have had to unload the camper and then find a jack somewhere, jack it up, and then in the parking lot. And I was tired. And remember, my knee didn't work. I was doing all this, climbing in and out of the truck, climbing under the truck, doing all this with a knee that was in incredible pain, and I just wasn't going to have it. But I'm still confused about this, because the truck, I mean, it's a big, full-size truck, 8-foot bed, 4-wheel drive, 5.7-liter Hemi, big truck. But you know what? It's not. All this time I was doing this research, I was trusting stats and things I was reading online. I typed the VIN to a VAN decoder, and it gave me a payload limit. I asked ChatGPT, I looked in forums. All the payload limits said that it was between 1,750 and 1,900 pounds, which made sense to me for a half-ton truck. You know what I didn't do? I never looked at the sticker on the truck. This is dumb. I'm telling you this so that you won't be dumb like me. There's no point in looking at reports of things if you have the actual thing and the official document of record for the payload capacity of a vehicle is on the door jamb. That's the thing that counts. And I looked at the door jamb and my jaw dropped, because the payload capacity of my big truck is 1,453 pounds. The weight of the camper is 1,483 pounds. The camper weighs more than the payload capacity of my big truck. And that doesn't count, you know, me, my considerable weight, the jackery I had with me, all the stuff I had, like sleeping bags, all that weight. Yeah, I had overloaded my truck. What's amazing about this is if you look at the payload capacity of, say, a Ford Maverick, which is the small truck they make, or a Ford Ranger, or a Toyota Tacoma, you know, the little trucks, although Rangers are pretty big, they all have more payload capacity than my truck. See, what's weird about my truck is that it's not available to the general market. It is a fleet vehicle. It was made specifically for fleets, and it was sold as fleets, and then on the secondary market, CarMax, where I bought it, you know, the general public could get a hold of them, but they didn't match the specs of any other vehicle. And apparently, this vehicle was designed to have a big bed that couldn't carry much weight. Part of the problem is that my truck is four-wheel drive. That adds a lot of weight, which takes off the payload. Also, I have a 33-gallon gas tank. Massive gas tank, but that also comes out of payload. My truck is wimpy. I have wimpy truck. And I have just bought this small truck camper that's too big for the vehicle, and I have to drive 300 miles before I can get rid of it. Well, not when I say get rid of it, I'm not getting rid of it. It is my new vehicle. I am back in van life, baby. I have a camping vehicle. It just needs a lot of work, and I have to figure something out with this weight problem. But I had to go 300 miles. So the way to do that is go slow. And I considered not driving interstates back, and I looked at the maps, and I was like, God, what is safer, to go slow on the interstates or to stick to secondary roads where you have to brake all the time? And remember, right knee doesn't work. Braking and accelerating, ouch, that was going to be painful. So I made the decision to drive as fast as possible that was safe on the interstates. And I did 55 miles an hour all the way back from Lansing to LaSalle. And any time the truck started moving funny, I slowed down. The other drivers probably weren't too pleased with me, but I was within the law. I was driving above the minimum speed on all these roads. I was in the right-hand lane, and I drove strategically such that I wouldn't be in the way for people coming onto the highway or trying to get where they needed to be. I was a courteous driver, which is all I could do. But that didn't actually go all that well in some cases. First off, the rolling from side to side I could mitigate pretty well. I realized that as soon as that started happening, I could wiggle the steering wheel a little bit and then slow down, and that would cancel it out. So that was a good thing to learn. By the end of the trip, I had pretty much solved that problem, and I was able to do 60 miles an hour comfortably without any worries. But Indiana... Indiana and I have issues, but Indiana is redoing their highways, and some of them are very nice, and some of them use this new concrete that isn't even, and it has seams. Where the seam is, the road surface goes down just a little bit, so it's this little dip, and they're all evenly spaced. Remember that resonance word? Well, I had it the other way. The truck was hitting these and porpoising, which means the front would go up and down and up and down, and then the back would follow up and down and up and down. And then I could see the overhang of the truck camper going up and down, at an opposite frequency to the way the truck was moving. And this is bad. This is bad. So I was hoping it was just temporary, and it was. And by the time I got to the next exit where I could turn off, I was able to get off of this new resonance frequency problem and check the camper. And what I found was not a good thing. Those wiggly tie-downs, and this is the part attached to the truck camper, were now just flat-out loose. They were still attached to the truck camper, but they were loose, and I was very concerned that I was simply going to rip them out. And that would be bad, because at speed, if you rip one of those things out, then I was using ratchet straps, the strap would then have fallen onto the ground, headed straight for the rear axle, and possibly gotten wrapped around it. So I stopped and reloaded the truck in a different way. Instead of using those tie downs, I actually used the jacks that lift up the camper, which is the second strongest point, although at that time it was the strongest point. And then I drove and drove and drove, and then it got dark. Why does that matter? Well, another thing that happens when you overload your vehicle is if the back end goes down, the front end goes up, and your headlights go up. So your low beams become your high beams, or brights, as they call them in the Midwest for some reason. And basically, I'm blinding all the drivers on the other side of the road, and there's nothing I can do. I have to drive with my headlights on. I was literally stuck. So I just decided to stay the course, and then finally, at 10:15 p.m., I pulled into Tiki Bago Land and unloaded the camper. That is now my new van life vehicle, and you'll be hearing a lot more about it, but it's going to sit there for a little bit until I have time to fix it. But here's the thing. Despite all that, I have a vehicle I want. It was at the price I wanted. It is now in my control. Truck campers have a lot of advantages that aren't obvious. For example, you don't have to register them, so there's no registration to pay. There's no stickers or anything like that. It's just cargo. I didn't have to pay any sales tax because it's not a vehicle. It doesn't have to be registered. I don't have to insure it. It's just cargo. And it's ultimately just a wooden box. And I can fix a wooden box. Whatever's wrong with it, as soon as I sort out where the water damage is, first step, find where the water's coming in. Second, figure out where it went. Third, remove anything that's rotten. I will go through all that. I will do that. Then I will have the camping vehicle that I want for now. You know how this is. 2 years from now, 2 years from now, you're going to hear about how I'm turning a school bus into a camper, or I'm moved onto a boat, or I've decided to take up cycling and I've got some kind of a camping reggae tow behind a bicycle. I don't know. Maybe I'll do horses. I've never been on a horse. Maybe I'll do that. I don't know. So anyway, that is why there was no podcast yesterday, and that is why there is one today instead. So thank you for indulging me for all of that. And I'm back. I'm back. I feel legitimate again. And holy cow, this has gone long, so I'm actually cutting out two sections, but I will have them for you next week. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 261. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. Again, thank you guys very, very much for your support. If you ever need to get in touch with me, I am Jeff at built2go.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. Until next time, remember the words of Stuart Adamson, who said, The house on fire holds no shame, but I will be coming home again.